I next met with Dr. Dan Hayes from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and to begin, I asked him to provide some background on the TAILOR-X study, which was presented at the ASCO plenary session in June and subsequently published in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Actually, if I can, I'd like to try to separate what I think is some confusion. There are two separate issues. One is prognosis and one is prediction. And by prognosis, I mean, does the patient have a sufficiently high risk of subsequent recurrence that if chemotherapy worked, you would give it? Or the mirror image of that is, does she have such a low chance of subsequent distant recurrence that even if chemotherapy worked, it can't help enough people to outweigh the toxicities of the therapy? And overall, it looks like about 1% to 2% of patients who receive adjuvant chemotherapy will have a life-taking, life-threatening, or permanently life-changing toxicity. 100%, of course, will have what I call the annoying side effects, which are usually temporary but resolved. You know, nausea, vomiting, which we control very well now, hair loss, which almost always returns. I've never seen it not. Fatigue, those sorts of things. But the real issues are the 1% to 2% that really have some sort of, again, life-taking, life-threatening, or life-changing toxicities.
Could I just clarify, though, when you say 1% to 2%, would you use that same number for four cycles of TC?
Well, that's a broad paint stroke I just made. So, for example, if you're 40 years old, you probably have a lower chance of those three things than if you're my age, if you're, you know, getting into your late 60s, 70s, or 80s. If you have comorbid illnesses, it's going to be higher. If you don't, it's going to be lower. The kind of therapy you get, you're right. For example, doxorubicin brings into play second myeloid malignancies or congestive heart failure. Both of those are uncommon, but they certainly occur. If you don't give doxorubicin, those are almost off the table. If you bring in the taxanes, peripheral neuropathy can really be life-changing and not go away. There are a number of investigators doing really first-rate research to trying to figure out why some people get it and others don't. Are there ways to prevent it? Are there ways to treat it? So far, with a few exceptions, we're really owed for everything there, not for lack of trying. There's been some really terrific research, but it just hasn't helped. So I think no matter what you give, there's always some risk of one of those three things. And again, I think it's about 1% or 2%. Now, the reason that's important is, let's say you have a 20% risk of distant recurrence if you do no systemic therapy. And if your estrogen receptor is positive, then anti-estrogen therapy probably reduces that by somewhere between a third and half. So let's say we drop it to 15%. With anti-estrogen therapy, and all of us would agree patients should take that. Chemotherapy appears to work across the board by reducing the risk of subsequent recurrence by approximately one-third. That's what the Oxford Overview says, and the Oxford Overview implies that it is regardless of your ER, your HER2, PR, that we've looked up side down every which way we can in the Oxford Overview and have not been able to find anything that is predictive that it works better in this group than that group. So a one-third reduction of risk of distant recurrence when you start out with a 15% risk is 5. That's a bit of an overestimate. I won't go through all the math of how that works, but let's just take that 5 out of 100 women would benefit from getting adjuvant chemotherapy in that setting. 1% or 2% will have a life taking, threatening, or changing toxicity. Is 4 or 5 high enough above 1 or 2 that it's worthwhile? And what Oncotype DX did 15 years ago with Soon Paik's original paper and then several subsequent papers, and by the way, now there are several other assays that have been brought into play that the ASCO Tumor Marker Guidelines panel have also recommended could be used. What we find is that about half of the patients who fall into that setting have really low scores, and assuming they get appropriate adjuvant endocrine therapy, then their risk of subsequent recurrence is going to be 2 or 3%, and not high enough above the 1% or 2% that it's worth giving them chemotherapy. On the other hand, if they have a high recurrence score, it looks like that in that case, they've got maybe still a residual 15% or 20% risk of recurrence, even with adjuvant endocrine therapy. And a third of, say, 20% is 6 or 7, and that's probably high enough above 1 or 2 that the benefits outweigh the risk. Still, when the Oncotype DX data were first presented, and we had this low recurrence, high recurrence, a quarter of patients still fell into this intermediate score. So as soon as we saw Dr. Paik's data and the NSABP data, we had a big meeting, I'll never forget it, of what was called the intergroup in those days, is now called the Breast Cancer Steering Committee. And we all scratched our heads and said, well, what do we do with this intermediate group? And to his credit, Joe Sperano designed and conducted the TAILOR-Rx trial led by ECOG, but everybody chipped in, as you know, put thousands of patients on that study. And we learned a lot from that study. The first thing is Dr. Sperano and his colleagues in ECOG and at the NCI decided to, I call it, frame shift the cutoffs. So the original cutoffs were 18 and 31, and the intermediate group was between 18 and 31. They moved it to 11 to 25. I actually argued against doing that. Joe Sperano and I are very good friends. We've laughed over this for years, but I said, as George Kanellis taught me a long time ago when I was a fellow, you said, dance with the girl you brought to the party. I felt we should stick with the cutoffs we had. But they were concerned about under-treating patients if we weren't careful. And at the time, we didn't know a lot about what we were doing. So we shifted it to 11 to 25. And what we learned was, A, if you're ER positive and node negative, and you have a low recurrence score, and in that case, less than 11, the odds of your recurring, assuming you get appropriate adjuvant endocrine therapy, are 1 or 2% at most over the next 5 to 10 years. That paper was published, again, with Joe, his first author, in the New England Journal 4 or 5 years ago. I can't remember how many. And so that validated the concept that if you have a really good prognosis, even if chemotherapy reduces your risk of recurrence, it doesn't reduce it enough to outweigh the possible toxicities. And in my opinion, that's a great benefit. It means we could quit giving chemotherapy to patients who don't need it. What the current TAILOR-Rx data show that he presented at ASCO and then was published in the New England Journal this summer, on which I'm a co-author, so I've got a little bit of a conflict here. But anyway, is that in the intermediate group, basically what we did is just collapse the cutoff to 25. And so now, for the average patient who walks in the door who's node negative, ER positive, and has an oncotype of 25 or less, they probably don't need chemotherapy, assuming they get adequate endocrine therapy. It may work there, but it may not reduce the odds large enough to justify the treatment because so few people are going to recur in the first place in that group. There's some nuances there we can get into, especially with younger people, younger women. But for a postmenopausal woman, I think that's good news. We bumped the cutoff from 18 to 25. So if you're 25 or less, you don't need chemotherapy. If you're node negative, don't take it. If you're 31 or greater, you need the chemotherapy. There's no reason to believe it won't work. The Oxford Overview says it works almost no matter what your biology is, and so you should take it. We're still left with this 25 to 31 group, and we're all going to have to rub our hands. We're not sure we know what to do with that, and that's the problem with having changed the cutoffs. Regardless, I think this has been a big step forward. It really validates what we're doing. It's collapsed the cutoffs to 25 or so. The second issue is with prediction, and that is, does the relative benefit of chemotherapy, not the absolute, but the relative benefit, change going from a low recurrence score or so-called luminal A disease all the way out to high recurrence score or even estrogen receptor negative? In other words, let's say, for example, instead of being a one-third reduction no matter what, it's a one-half reduction if your estrogen receptor is negative and a one-tenth reduction if your luminal A low recurrence score. And I think, actually, Mark Lipman first reported this idea in a New England Journal paper in 1977. And you know how you can kind of remember where you were when the first man walked on the moon or when President Kennedy. I remember where I was. I was a third-year medical student. Larry Einhorn showed me this paper in the New England Journal and said, this is going to change practice. And so Mark predicted that from a very small study in metastatic disease that ER-negative patients would benefit from chemotherapy, ER-positives wouldn't. That became very controversial. The data bounced all over the place over the next 15 or 20 years. But most of us believe, actually, that the accumulated body of evidence suggests that this is true. That if you go left to right on that recurrence score, or left to right on the intrinsic subtype, if you will, that patients who have really high ER, low HER2, low proliferation are very likely to benefit from endocrine therapy, but that chemotherapy, whether you need it or not, just may not work. Whereas if you go to the other side, say completely ER negative, chemotherapy may work a whole lot better. TAILOR-RX does not directly address that. They're all node negative, so they all have good prognosis to begin with, and then it's, you have a really good prognosis or modestly poor prognosis. The RxPONDER trial, which was based on Kathy Albing's paper we published in Lancet Oncology from the old SWOG study of node-positive, ER-positive patients, suggested just that, that as you go left to right, the relative benefits of chemotherapy get greater and greater and greater. And so therefore, if you have a bad prognosis and you have a low recurrence, a bad prognosis anatomically, large tumor, multiple positive nodes, but a low recurrence, it's not that you don't need the chemotherapy, it's that it won't work. It's the equivalent of your estrogen receptor negative. It's not that you don't need adjuvant endocrine therapy, it just won't work. If your HER2 is negative, it's not that you don't need trastuzumab, it just won't work. And so the theory is if you're low recurrence, regardless of your anatomic prognosis, chemotherapy just won't work. We went to the Oxford overview, and I'm going to tell you, we turned it every which way but loose. A very nice paper published in The Lancet a few years ago, looking at all the ways, the subgroups in which chemotherapy versus no chemotherapy was done. We don't have Oncotype DX in the Oxford overview, or we don't have any kind of molecular testing. All we have is ER, PR, progesterone receptor. Sometimes we have grade or key 67, we have age. We could not find any group in which the relative benefits of chemotherapy weren't roughly a one-third reduction. And so in SWOG, based on our study from 8814, which by the way is very similar to a paper that Soon Paik had published in the node negative group already, but we felt like we really needed at least one or two more validating prospective retrospective studies, and we just couldn't find them. They just don't exist out there. So we started a new prospective trial called RxPONDER. Kevin Kolinsky's been the PI of this study. It is now fully accrued for node-positive patients. Unfortunately, it's only 1 to 3 positive node patients, but it's node-positive patients. And if their Oncotype DX is less than 25, they all got standard endocrine therapy, and half got chemotherapy and half did not. So we're trying to test there the predictive value of Oncotype DX, as opposed to the prognosis. Now, they get confused because you can't really separate prognosis and prediction. But nonetheless, what we're going to have there are node-positive patients. So presumably, they need chemotherapy. The question is, will it work if they're less than 25? And we're waiting for the results of that study. I'll tell you a cute story, Neil. I had a patient about a year and a half ago who was node-negative, ER-positive, and had an Oncotype recurrence score of about 24 or 25. So it was in the intermediate group. And this was, of course, before TAILOR-RX had been reported out. And I went through all this long-winded hand-waving, and at the end she said, well, Dr. Hayes, I understand all that, but I need to know, should I get chemotherapy or not? And I said, well, the trouble is I can't tell you because we got this big trial. We're waiting for the results. We thought we'd already have the results by now, but we haven't. And I said to her, you know, the problem is, you're all doing much better than you used to do, that we're having a hard time getting an answer. And as soon as I did that, Neil, I thought, that's not a problem. That was a stupid thing to say to a patient. You know, the problem is we can't get our research done. The good news is we think that patients, especially with ER-positive breast cancer, are doing much better than they were 30 years ago. So the results from the old NSABP trials and the old SWOG trials may not be quite as applicable to a patient these days as they were before, and there are a number of reasons why that may be.
Can you talk a little bit, this patient you just mentioned, how old was she roughly?
She was 55 or so.
So she was postmenopausal?
Yeah, postmenopausal, sort of standard, you know.
And she had a recurrence score, you said, of 24, 25?
Yeah.
And what did she end up doing?
She ended up not taking chemotherapy.
And I'm just kind of curious, if you were to see a patient in that exact situation today, first of all, what would you say to her? And second of all, how would that change if she were 40 and premenopausal?
Yeah. So let's be clear. This was a postmenopausal node negative ER positive patient. If I saw her today, I would say with confidence, I don't believe you need chemotherapy because the TAILOR-Rx data suggest you don't need it. If she were node positive, that same patient, I would say, I'm not sure I know what to do, but at least right now, I think the standard of care for especially a multiple node positive patient is chemotherapy until the responder data come out and tell us otherwise or don't tell us otherwise. I mean, that's the whole point of research. Now, back to your question. What if the same patient, node negative, ER positive, but she's 40 and premenopausal? This gets really complex, and I'm sorry I'm waving my hands around, but it takes a lot of hand waving to do this. In the TAILOR-Rx trial, again, those patients were randomly assigned to chemotherapy versus not, but they all got, quote, standard of care endocrine therapy. And the standard of care endocrine therapy when TAILOR-Rx started for a premenopausal woman was tamoxifen. While that study was being conducted, of course, the SOFT and TEXT data matured, have now been presented. I'm sure you've seen those. And they both suggest that in a patient, especially with a relatively poorer prognosis or relatively really young age, the use of ovarian ablation, either with by chemical or by surgery, plus aromatase inhibition, is better than ovarian ablation plus tamoxifen, and especially better than tamoxifen alone. Those are the SOFT data. Now, in TAILOR-Rx, the one place we saw that 25 is not necessarily the cutoff is in young women less than 50, presumably premenopausal, and most of them probably got tamoxifen only. And those curves start to separate at about 20 instead of about 25, the separation between the curves between chemotherapy and no chemotherapy. The question there is, should they have gotten chemotherapy, and did chemotherapy work because it killed the cancer cells, or was chemotherapy actually doing what happened in SOFT, where you did ovarian ablation and put patients on an AI? And so could you get the same effect using ovarian ablation plus an AI rather than giving chemotherapy? And is that safer in the long run? So the nuances are, for example, we know that early menopause outside the cancer arena is associated with an increased risk of toxicity in the long run, increased risk of mortality in the long run based on osteoporosis, fractures, increased risk of cardiovascular and cerebrovascular disease. There are a number of papers in the GYN literature suggesting that. In SOFT and TEXT, we haven't seen those occur, but we haven't followed those patients that long to really know that. So the question there is whether the acute effects of chemotherapy and the 1 or 2% life-taking, life-threatening, or life-changing toxicities of chemotherapy are worse or better than the long-term complications of intentional ovarian ablation with an aromatase inhibitor.
Could I just ask for practical purposes, if you were in that situation, and thinking about this woman and her personality, do you think you would have recommended chemotherapy, ovarian ablation, or both?
So we made my 55-year-old be 40, and I would probably recommend chemotherapy. But I have to tell you, I bet you if you put 10 of us in a room, you know, me, Hal Burstein, Eric Weiner, Cliff Huddis, Joe Sperano, so on and so forth, you would probably get about a 50-50 split between ovarian ablation and an AI versus chemo.
I actually don't think so yet. Maybe in the future. Let me ask you one other thing about this patient.
So you think more people would still give chemotherapy
yes.
to that patient?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, some would do both, but I think people would give chemo. A lot would do both. Another question. How large was this woman's tumor? She was node negative. How big was the tumor?
Oh, she was about 2.5 centimeters.
And if it had been 3.5 centimeters, would that have changed the way you thought about it?
Yeah, so one of the issues there, Neil, I think, goes back to the original Oncotype DX data that were generated from the NSABP. Those patients were all node negative, and most of them were grouped in the, you know, 2 to 5 centimeter region. One of the issues is, what if you're above 5 centimeters? Your prognosis there, even if you're node negative, begins to look as if you were node positive. So can we trust Oncotype DX to give us a prognosis in patients who are above 3 or 4 or 5 centimeters the way we do if it's 2 to 3 centimeters? And this gets fuzzy around the edges because there just weren't many people that size tumors who were in those trials or in the subsequent studies that have been reported, ATAC and some others. And, you know, the question there, again, goes back to prognosis and prediction.
And yeah, bottom line was, postmenopausal lady, she's 55. She's got a 3.5 centimeter node negative tumor with her current score of 24. What is your likely response?
So 5 years ago, I would have leaned over towards saying, I think you ought to think about chemotherapy a little more than you are right now. Now, I'm not so sure. So now, again, 55-year-old, node negative, ER positive, and a 3.5 centimeter tumor with an oncotype of 24 or 25, I'd probably say endocrine therapy alone. Now, if you give her node positive disease, I'd say we need the responder trial. And I would still recommend chemotherapy. I'll say it again, I want to emphasize, especially if it's multiple node positive, 2, 3, or 4 or more nodes. A single node, I don't know, I'm on the fence there because that may well, a patient with a single node in 2018 probably would have been called many times node negative back in the 1980s because of the way we've changed how we handle lymph nodes and sentinel nodes and that sort of thing. So I do say that if I've got a patient with a single node, I recommend, especially if it's a small amount of tumor, and that's arbitrary, but say less than 0.5 centimeter, I'm not opposed to using Oncotype DX in such a patient and just treating her as if she were node negative. But if she's got a larger component of disease in a single node, extracapsular extension, or multiple positive nodes, I consider that patient node positive, and I still consider that chemotherapy is the treatment of choice for a node positive patient until responder reports out and tells us that's right or wrong.
So one final variation, we could keep doing this all day long, but one final one is that same lady, 55 years old, same thing we've been talking about. She's got one node, she's got two nodes, but her recurrence score is 10.
Yeah, so I get this email once a week, Neil, from oncologists all over the country. And let's give her 3 nodes, okay?
Three nodes.
And her Oncotype DX is 10.
I just want to see if I could get you up to 2 nodes.
Well, my answer is usually get in a time machine, go backwards, and don't send the assay, because I don't think it's indicated in a patient who has a bad anatomic prognosis until responder tells us yes or no. I know I'm at odds with some of my colleagues, but I still, chemotherapy works, and I don't think we should be withholding it unless we're sure it doesn't work just because of the Oncotype DX. But let's say a single node. And again, if her Oncotype DX was 10 and it was, let's say, a less than 0.5 centimeter deposit with no extra capsular invasion, I would say we're going to treat you as if you're node negative, you got a low Oncotype. I think endocrine therapy alone is perfectly appropriate for that patient.
So I want to move on and talk about metastatic disease in the ER positive, node negative situation, but just 2 final questions in terms of genomic predictors. The first is, any thoughts you have about genomic predictors, including recurrence score in the neoadjuvant setting? We found in our surveys that there's a fair number of investigators, maybe a third, who use it, you know, to determine whether to use chemo, whether to use hormones, whether to go to surgery. And the other issue I wanted to ask you about is the use of genomic factors as predictors in metastatic disease.
So let's take the neoadjuvant first. To be a little controversial, in my own opinion, the only benefit of giving neoadjuvant chemotherapy that's been proven is it allows you to do surgery you might not otherwise have done or do less surgery than you would have done. So, for example, as you know, if you have locally advanced breast cancer, neoadjuvant chemotherapy can shrink it to a point where it is, I hate it when people use air quotes, but operable. In other words, the surgeon says it's not operable because this is what Higgins had said is not operable, but now it becomes smaller and it becomes operable. Likewise, if you've got a patient that you believe needs a mastectomy and you give neoadjuvant chemotherapy, about 15% of those patients become patients for whom breast-preserving therapy is appropriate.
You could also make the argument you're avoiding some axillary node dissections also.
Well, it could help you avoid node dissection, but I'm not sure of that yet. So in other words, I think there's a lot of neoadjuvant chemotherapy given to help investigators and to ask important investigational questions, but not necessarily a benefit to that patient. The reason I'm bringing that up, the second point is, although response to neoadjuvant chemotherapy does predict better outcomes than a lack of response, especially past CR, it doesn't mean that chemotherapy didn't work. So if I were to use an Oncotype DX to decide neoadjuvant chemotherapy or not, I wouldn't do that. I would use Oncotype DX to decide whether I'm going to give chemotherapy or not, the same discussion we just had. If it's low, I don't think that patient should receive chemotherapy at any time if she's node negative, and therefore I would proceed with whatever you're going to do surgery-wise and give her endocrine therapy. If I were going to give her chemotherapy at all, I actually personally don't care if you give it before the surgery or after the surgery. And the only patients I strongly recommend before surgery are those who have a larger tumor who would be a candidate for breast-preserving therapy if it shrunk. So, for example, at least in our hands, if a patient has widespread calcifications all through her breast, and it doesn't matter how much the tumor shrinks, you're still going to do a mastectomy. I don't see what neoadjuvant therapy does. A mastectomy is a mastectomy, whether you do it before or after the chemotherapy. So personally, we've not been using this so much, but we don't use very much neoadjuvant therapy, especially in ER-positive patients in general, just because the odds of actually benefiting that patient with neoadjuvant versus postadjuvant are pretty low in ER-positive patients. Doesn't mean we don't give adjuvant chemotherapy to that patient. That's where we use Oncotype DX.
So, of course, the situation is very different when we talk about triple-negative, HER2-positive. What about in the metastatic setting?
So I've never used genomic score in the metastatic setting to make a decision. You know, again, what are we trying to do in the metastatic setting? I think all oncologists agree with this. We're not going to cure those patients, or rarely do we cure such patients. We're trying to make them, I tell my own patients, we're going to try to make you feel as good as you can for as long as you can. And that means picking therapy most likely to work with the fewest side effects. And if a patient's estrogen receptor positive, I think you're in tricky business to bypass endocrine therapy and go right to chemotherapy based on an Oncotype DX recurrence score. I don't think it tells us you can do that. So the only patients I would bypass endocrine therapy and go straight to chemotherapy, which has more toxicity, are those patients with rapidly progressive visceral disease and end organ dysfunction. And that's not just liver mets, but liver mets that's been growing rapidly. You have evidence of that. LFTs are 2 or 3 or 4 times normal, maybe bilirubin's a bit up, or pulmonary disease where the patient's actually already symptomatic. Those are situations in which you're probably only going to get one chance. And in my opinion, you probably ought to use combination chemotherapy. And at least I tell my own patients, we're trying to buy some wiggle room. We want to shrink the tumor down so you feel well enough that then we can maybe go back to a less toxic and potentially active therapy like endocrine therapy. But we need some wiggle room before we do that. That, by the way, is a very unusual case. Most patients who are ER positive present without end organ dysfunction. They may have a couple liver mets, a couple pulmonary mets, but they don't have end organ dysfunction. They're not symptomatic from that. And in my opinion, I would not bypass endocrine therapy based on any other kind of test.
So I want to use the remainder of the interview to just pick your brain about some of the recent developments in the treatment of breast cancer, particularly the introduction of new and novel agents. I want to start out by asking you about metastatic. We talked about ER positive in the early stage, but in the metastatic setting, and particularly get your take on the introduction of CDK4/6 inhibitors. Can you kind of comment on that globally?
Yeah, I think they've been a real step forward. I mean, there's a lot of controversy about whether they actually improve survival or not. And it's probably going to be hard to figure that out because the crossover of all but one randomized trial has been pretty high because the drugs have become available in standard of care. And so a lot of patients who didn't get it with the first treatment got it with the second treatment. And that's probably true in the clinical trials too. So it's going to be difficult to get, because we're not asking CDK4/6 inhibitor versus not ever. We're basically asking CDK4/6 inhibitor early on the trial or at some later point off trial. And very few drugs have shown survival benefit in a metastatic setting when the drug is available later. Trastuzumab is one of them. the first trastuzumab versus not, the Slaman study in the New England Journal in 2001, I think, allowed crossover because the drug became available, and yet there was a survival benefit of trastuzumab versus not in the trial, meaning early versus late, even in the metastatic setting, made a difference in survival. And of course, the Mona Lisa trial showed the same thing for the combination of trastuzumab and pertuzumab versus trastuzumab alone. So those are remarkable studies, but in general, they've not. So with the CDK4/6, I think we're back to, are we going to make the patient feel better for as long as we can? And the thing I like about them is that they clearly increase response rates, they clearly increase time to progression, and yet they bring very little physical toxicity to the game. We got to watch white cells. There's a slightly increased risk of infection, although I think all of us have become quite comfortable in how to do that. It's basically chemotherapy light, but they don't cause nausea, vomiting, hair loss, all, you know, peripheral neuropathy. They're really pretty easy medicines to take.
Are there any situations in terms of first-line therapy of metastatic disease, ER-positive, HER2-negative, where you think it's reasonable to withhold the use of a CDK inhibitor?
Yeah, well, as I said, the final toxicity is financial toxicity, Neil. And this is something that we're all, as you know, unless you're hiding in a cave, we're all struggling with. These are very expensive drugs. All three of them on the market are very expensive. I've had several patients not able to take them because they can't afford the copay or their insurance companies just won't pay for them. And, you know, I'm not the only person worried about that. Obviously, ASCO just has published a big review of this. The President of the United States has brought it to the fore. We've got to deal with this. Now, going back to your question, because I think they're related, are there patients in whom I would not recommend it? And I don't think we know that. So far, all of the prospective, retrospective trials of the CDK4/6 inhibitor versus NIL studies have failed to demonstrate anything that says this is a group of patients who clearly do not need it or do not benefit from the added therapy, and this is a group of patients who get all kinds of benefit. Not for lack of trying, by the way, and people are still trying, and I'm involved in some studies where we're trying to figure out, is there a group of patients who do so well with endocrine therapy alone, either single agent or combination endocrine therapies, that they're not going to benefit from the CDK4/6 inhibitors because they don't need it.
Can you talk a little bit about what we know about each of the three approved CDK inhibitors and from your point of view, how you decide which one to use?
Yeah, I will tell you, in my own practice, I've almost exclusively used palbociclib, and that's just because it was first. You know, there are no head-to-head comparisons, so we can't talk about head-to-head comparison of activity or toxicity. There's some evidence that palbo may have fewer side effects than ribo or abemo. You know, these are the ciclibs. But I don't know we can actually say that without head-to-head comparisons, and they've not been done. So I use palbo just because it's the first one out there and I got used to it and I haven't changed. I can't say that there's a compelling reason to use or not use one of the other two instead of palbo. They all seem to work the same way. Their mechanism of action is the same. And as far as I can see, the relative benefits in cross-trial comparisons look pretty similar. So I don't know what other people have said that you've interviewed, but I use palbo because, again, to quote George Kanellis, a dance with the girl I brought to the party, you know, it was the first one there and I'm comfortable with it.
Well, I've heard discussion in terms of the difference in sort of the side effects profile that I've heard people say that ribo and palbo are very similar in terms of the neutropenia, but with abema, you get more GI toxicity and less cytopenias. Is that the way you see it?
Yeah. Again, all of these are compared to placebo and not to each other. You know, the BMO trials happen to inadvertently select people more likely to get diarrhea than the other two. The only way we're going to get to this is to put them head to head. That certainly is the perspective, and I've heard that too. Again, I've personally not used the BMO, not because I don't like it, it's just haven't used it, but some of my colleagues have. We have 10 medical oncologists in our group, and we meet once a week, so we talk to each other. I mean, one of the issues is whether any one of these drugs gets across the blood-brain barrier and whether one gets across better than the others. The group that developed Abemo have reported that, at least in animals, it seems to cross over the blood-brain barrier, so perhaps it might be a drug that would be useful for brain metastasis. They've been running those trials. I haven't seen any data yet, though. So, again, I think it's awfully hard to put a playing card between the three.
Any comments in terms of the difference in sort of the schedule and that the ribo and palbo is, you know, they take a week off and with Abema it's continuous and whether or not there's any potential benefit one way or the other?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I think this gets to be then a personal issue, patient to patient. I don't know if you're taking any medicines, and I don't want to know, but I'm going to be open about this. I take Fosamax. I have osteoporosis. It's a long story. It's a once-a-week therapy. I have to put a little sign on my mirror where I shave, take your drug today. Today's the day of the week to take it. And my point here is it's much easier to remember daily treatments because you just take them every morning with breakfast than it is where you're off and, you know, on for 3 weeks and off. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but in my 36 years talking to patients, and I'm a patient now myself, you forget where you are. I mean, day-to-day life, fortunately, takes over your medical life, and you begin to forget what, oh gosh, is this, you know, am I supposed to take it or not? So I think there are pros and cons in both of these, and I don't have, again, I think it's, you know, I've had some patients say I'd rather take a pill every day, and others say, you know, if you can give it to me IV, I'd rather come in once every 3 weeks and just get a shot.
So I want to switch over and get your thoughts about triple negative disease. And one thing that I'm starting to hear about, and maybe there's going to be some data presented, is the possibility of using a checkpoint inhibitor metastatic triple negative disease combined with chemotherapy. Any comments in general about checkpoint inhibitors in breast cancer and this what could be emerging strategy?
I think these are very exciting. I mean, as you know, the last 150 years, people have been trying to get the immune system to go after our own cancer cells with minimal success, in my opinion, an occasional response here with melanoma or renal cell there, but really not much until three or four folks who did so figured out how to break tolerance, and those are the checkpoints, and how to then inhibit the checkpoints so our own immune cells see our own cells. It's a good thing they don't, or we'd all have rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and basically graft versus host disease. But the question is, could we do it selectively? And as you know, that's been one of the great hits in the last 5 years. I never thought I'd say this in my career, and neither did you, Neil, that we can now probably cure 20% of patients with metastatic melanoma. And I have to say, that's a gee whiz, and the treatment for all the other diseases. So the question is, what about breast cancer? So far, the results up until recently have been pretty unexciting of the checkpoint inhibitors with breast cancer. But probably one of the problems is that trying to figure out where these drugs work and why. It's not as clean as ER positive, ER negative, HER2 positive, HER2 negative, and response to endocrine therapy or anti-HER2 therapy, respectively. There are a number of predictive factors, all of which have probably combined in one patient to be a predictive index. And by those, I mean things like PD-L1 expression, mutational load, HLA status, now more recently microbiome in your GI system. And I don't think any one of these is going to be a single predictive factor. Put them all together. And then within breast cancer, basically the people who've been doing the studies have used the markers we use to decide about endocrine therapy, ER, or the markers we decide about HER2, and said, well, if you don't make those, so-called triple negative might respond to the checkpoint inhibitors. Well, triple negative is a wastebasket of a bunch of different diseases. So, and by the way, ER-positive breast cancer that becomes refractory to endocrine therapy begins to act like triple negative, even though it was ER-positive. So we need more biology. But there is a single study now, and all we know is a press release. So I'm a little reluctant to talk publicly with just a press release that a study in triple negative patients of a checkpoint inhibitor versus nil has, quote, met its primary endpoint. I don't know what that means. We'll see more about this. I suspect we'll see it at San Antonio. And so I'd be more than willing to talk to you once we know those results, Neil, but I don't know much else about it. Certainly right now, I would not recommend any checkpoint inhibitors for breast cancer outside of a clinical trial. I don't think we have enough information to suggest we know if it works or where.
Just to clarify, though, in terms of what you were saying, I think it was a checkpoint inhibitor or not, but I think it's with a taxane, which is kind of a little bit different.
It was. It was chemotherapy with or without checkpoint inhibitor.
Right. So sort of diverging to another novel form of systemic therapy that has come into breast cancer, often considered in triple negative, but not exclusively so, is the issue of PARP inhibitors, specifically in patients with BRCA mutations and maybe even other germline mutations. Can you talk a little bit about your take on that?
Yeah. So personally, I've only used a PARP inhibitor in one patient. This just has to do with how I've begun to slow my practice down. But B, I have followed this with great interest. And in fact, the original laparib study was a plenary session at my ASCO meeting when I was president. So I obviously followed it quite closely. I mean, the PARP inhibitors are really interesting drugs, and they're quite exciting. The results of that trial did suggest that a PARP inhibitor alone was actually more effective and less toxic than the use of chemotherapy in patients with triple-negative metastatic breast cancer who had progressed on one regimen of chemotherapy. Now, there are other studies that suggest other PARP inhibitors have similar results. The problem is that the benefit is not huge in terms of absolute response rates, and the time to progression differences have come together pretty quickly. So that suggests there's a fairly rapid development of resistance to these drugs, even if they work. And I think that's where the research has got to go, is why is that? And can we prevent that or reverse that resistance, combining these drugs with chemotherapy, for example, maybe so that perhaps they make the chemotherapy work better, figuring out why the resistance occurs. I mean, Alan Ashworth, who basically discovered BRCA2 and developed one of the original PARP inhibitors, has published data of cancers that were originally BRCA1 mutated, and then clones have emerged that are biallelic BRCA1 wild type. In other words, these cancers, we always think of them as mutating to bad things. These cancers are mutating back to the wild type, which makes them resistant to the PARP inhibitor. That's a really frightening observation, in my opinion, and it suggests that we need to learn a lot more about these cancers. Nonetheless, I still think if your patient has germline BRCA1 or 2, considering the use of these drugs is a reasonable thing to do.
I want to finish out with your thoughts about HER2-positive disease developments, particularly in the adjuvant and neoadjuvant setting. Obviously, two big issues that have come out on the table in the last couple of years have been pertuzumab and neratinib. Any thoughts?
Can I start that with a case you asked me to present?
Sure.
Because
yeah.
I saw her yesterday.
Absolutely. Awesome.
I'm old enough to remember when HER2 was a bad thing to have. As we now know, HER2 is probably a good thing to have. And I was in clinic yesterday. I saw two patients, both of whom had metastatic disease 10 or more years ago that was HER2 positive. Both of them are free of any evidence of metastatic disease at this time, with trastuzumab only, by the way. And just like I said, I never thought I'd say that 20% of melanoma patients with metastatic disease might be cured. I never thought I'd say that a HER2-positive breast cancer that's metastatic might be cured. And it's a remarkable story. You know, Dennis Slamon deserves all the credit he gets for this. That's really fabulous. So having said that, I just thought I'd bring up those cases because I think, you know, some of the young people don't recall how awful it was in the old days. In the adjuvant setting, I think all of us were pretty flabbergasted by the relatively small benefit in meaningful endpoints, progression-free survival and overall survival, I don't know yet, the combination of pertuzumab and trastuzumab versus trastuzumab alone in the adjuvant setting. That study did meet its intended outcome, but not by very much. The p-value was statistically significant, but there's a pretty small difference there. Should we use it or not? I think this becomes almost a cost-effective analysis. The nice thing would be is whether we could figure out, I mean, that study did suggest there are patients who benefit from the combination versus the single. The metastatic trial was so positive. You know, I think all of us were certain we'd see a huge difference in the adjuvant trial, but we haven't. And the question is, can we find things in those patients who benefited that tell us they're the ones who did versus those who didn't? And to my knowledge, there's nothing out there that says that. So I'm not sure how much benefit the combination versus single-agent trastuzumab is in the adjuvant setting. I still think it's worth using, especially in neoadjuvant therapy where the PASCR rates are higher. And if you're trying to shrink the tumor down and do less surgery, or if you've got a locally advanced cancer and you're trying to shrink it down so you can do some surgery, it's probably worthwhile to use both. But the long-term meaningful endpoints are not separated by very much. I would say the same thing about neratinib. The issue there is that after a year of trastuzumab, neratinib versus nil improved things even more, but not by very much. A year of oral neratinib is not a picnic. The drug has side effects, especially GI. They can be managed with the usual conservative approach with antidiarrheals, but nonetheless, it's still a pretty tough drug to take for a year. In our group, some of our patients have received it, especially if they have particularly poor prognoses to begin with, multiple positive nodes, that sort of thing. But we're not using it routinely just with any patient. And the same thing I think I could say is true with combination pertuzumab, trastuzumab versus trastuzumab alone. We really like that the so-called Dana-Farber data, the New England Journal paper from a few years ago, that if you've got a tumor less than 2 or 3 centimeters that's node negative and HER2 positive, paclitaxel alone plus trastuzumab alone, in other words, not combination chemotherapy and not combination anti-HER2 therapy, looks awfully good. I mean, the recurrence rate in that group now with longer follow-up even is less than 5%, close to 10 years now. So I don't think we need to add all these things to people, but I think there are probably selected patients with relatively poor prognosis where they become worthwhile.